netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today, Mike Seymour is going to talk with VFX supervisor Greg Butler from MPC in London about the film Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. There's been a lot of great stuff on the site at FX Guide I wanted to bring to your attention before we jumped into this. First of all, one of our most highly read articles was about the work Lola Visual Effects did on the X-Men series, where they aged the characters at the beginning of one of the X-Men movies. We have an article about the work they just finished on Captain America, where they made Chris Evans' character into a wimp. It's a really interesting piece. We've already had a high volume of hits on this, and I think you'll want to check that article out over on the homepage on FX Guide. There's also some pieces that we worked on with The Daily about Transformers, Dark Side of the Moon, talking to some ILM supervisors about the destruction of Chicago. I also wanted to point out Mike Seymour recently did a webinar for our friends over at Assimilate. You can find that over on the Assimilate site. It was kind of a little peek into what we do at over our sister site, FXPhD, our training site. Mike talked about solving digital capture workflow with the Red using Scratch. And it was a very nice little webinar, kind of giving you the overview of what the best approach is and how Mike uses Scratch to expedite workflow. Speaking of FXPhD, the term over there, this term that just started, I've been really enjoying the Background Fundamentals course. I just want to highlight the very first class in the series. Background Fundamentals, of course, is the course that everyone gets who signs up for a term at FXPhD. It's kind of our magazine-style show that tackles different topics that will be of interest to a wider group. The Background Fundamentals number one in this term is Mike talked to the folks at ILM about optical printers and shows an optical printer and explains the principles behind optical printing. It's just a great piece of visual effects history. But Mike took it to the next step and sat down with Stu Mashwitz, who worked at ILM in the days when the optical printers were being phased out, and actually sat with the optical printer guys and talked to them about everything they were doing and went to After Effects and duplicated all the processes mathematically and figured out everything they were doing. And in this class, Mike actually sits with Stu and they go through that After Effects project and show how that all works and what was all behind that. So that's just a really interesting kind of thing that I don't know where else you find, but check it out over at FXPhD. The new term started, and there's a lot of other great courses, but that's just one I wanted to highlight. All right, well, let's jump in. I know a lot of people are really into the series Harry Potter. I really enjoyed this film, and I'm really anxious to hear what Greg Butler, visual effects supervisor from MPC, has to say to Mike Seymour.
I guess I should start by saying thanks so much for joining us, because we do really appreciate it.
No problem. It's great to talk about this project.
It's a really significant project for the industry, isn't it? In every respect, it's been a great source of creative work. It's been a great source of developing the craft. And I've got to say, this last film, my kids put on the first one, I think it was, on the weekend before they went and saw it. And I was kind of stunned at how far the industry and you guys had progressed between the first film and the last. It must be a bit of an arc coming to a close for you guys.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's so many people in all the, you know, visual effects and everybody else on set. People's careers have been Harry Potter. I'm not exactly that. I only worked on two of them, but you can really trace a history of visual effects across the eight films.
Because you're on Order of the Phoenix for MPC.
Yes, fifth one, Order of the Phoenix.
Yeah. And so let's discuss the work that that MPC London did on this last film, which, by the way, is obviously going superbly well at the box office, but also I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. And I wanted to touch on some of the destruction stuff, if we could get started. And I'll work my way through some scenes, but actually one scene that I thought from the trailer just had a real cinematic feel to it, and it's just a small shot, I guess, in one sense, it wasn't very long. It was the Quidditch pitch on fire, and I believe that was one of the ones you guys did, but it just had such a great kind of... you saw that shot and a bunch of others in the trailer, and there was no doubt it was going to be a good film. How do you guys approach those destruction sequences?
That particular shot, the destruction, the Quidditch pitch... that went back like 2 years to this one piece of concept art that we did before they even shot the films, just to give some sort of epic shot that shows an iconic thing like the Quidditch pitch being destroyed. And you could see that this was it, you know, if they're destroying the Quidditch pitch, this is really the end. and it made its way into the movie because everybody fell in love with it for so long. For a long time, we didn't even know where in the movie it would occur. And everybody wanted to make sure there was a place for it. So as far as breaking that shot down, in the actual destruction, there's really only one tower's collapsing and then a bunch of fire and smoke. But it feels like a big destruction shot when technically it wasn't that complicated a piece of destruction work. You know, it was a pretty basic rigid body solve, the tower collapse. But you add in the fire, the smoke, the DNA work behind, and all of a sudden it's epic.
And I think there was also some nice camera work, both on that and a bunch of the other shots you did, because I'd like to move to the Room of Requirements, and you guys did, if not all of that, and most of that. And there's a lot of really nice cinematic work, but just in terms of camera lensing and the stuff on that. How much were you involved in getting that at the outset, or was there previs done separately that was fed to you? How did that work?
Well, we supplied the previs team this time around. We had been involved, various MPC teams had been sitting in production and doing previs for our bits and pieces all the way back, I guess, probably to Potter 4. But this time around, we all knew each other well enough. This time they kind of commissioned us to create a previs team for them for the last two films. So we had guys up there for probably a two-year period, and Room of Requirement was one of the big ones. And it's really one of the ones where the previs led to the final shots and the final cut, more literally than a lot of the other film, which really ebbed and flowed. But yeah, Room of Requirement, especially with all of the broom flying clips that really had to be planned out well, was all prevised by MPC. And we were part of, obviously, the technical breakdowns for shooting. Some of the shots changed a bit, but they really went out and shot what we all planned, and it came together pretty well from that end.
What I thought was really interesting about that from a technical point of view is we all know that that fluid sims find their way into, you know, fire and explosion and stuff, but this really was one of those classic cases of a river of fire. When I say classic cases, it's completely the wrong term because it was quite unique in the fact that it was fire moving like water. Can you discuss how you went about doing that?
Yeah, it was... We really tried to go with it like that. Water and fire had to mix together somehow, so we would have the TDs do a very much a water simulation first, get it flowing around, colliding with stacks of furniture, and then lay in a layer of fuel on top of all that. And we had to really get used to what that balance was, because we found initially we would do the water sim, then we'd have the fire, and the whole thing was just huge because we'd have this additional layer on top. So then we learned to turn down the water and make it seem too thin, so when the fire got on top of it, it kind of worked. It was all using Flowline again, like we'd done on Potter 5 and some other projects. And we've really gotten good at figuring out how to push that simulator around, but once again, we tried it in a new way we hadn't quite done. So we had a lot of the TDs coming off of Clash of the Titans and Dawn Treader doing really classic water sims, ocean water sims, and we had to get them to get those running down this set.
Now, the other thing about that is that it isn't just a flow problem, because we have to believe that the fire has malice, the fire has character, and the fire has purpose. So if we didn't add that in, you'd just have this idea that the flames were flowing like a natural phenomenon, but they weren't flowing like a natural phenomenon. They were like targeting. And I'm wondering, you worked on Narnia, Prince Caspian, right? And I believe Flowline did the Flowline stuff was used on the river coming to life with the kind of breaking of the bridge stuff. And that was the only thing I could think of that was anything like this. Is there any similarity between those two?
There is. I mean, Scanline did that River God sequence with Flowline, and so they certainly pushed it in a similar direction, and I have a feeling we probably benefited in their software versions from some of that work. I'm not sure specifically. We were looking as references creatively to... there's a Guinness commercial with horses coming out of Crashing Waves, and also Dee Dee's work on Fellowship of the Ring, Fords of Bruin. Horses coming out of waves again. It was all the idea that we had to have creatures emerging from fire that had to look like, if the river of fire weren't there, the creature wouldn't be there. They had to kind of come from the same place and be merged. And that balance was really tricky. We went months just trying to find a balance of controlled versus realistic phenomenon, because if you try to control a sim too much, it shows and it no longer looks like phenomenon. So it was a real tricky balance, and sometimes the TV would just have to try until they got the settings just right and then not touch them.
I can imagine the sims would take quite a lot of time to actually simulate, because that was quite a physical space to work in. Was it computationally heavy?
Not particularly, because we only simmed mostly what we needed to see. Collision objects, you know, having them more and more detailed would slow it down, but for the most part, we never had to deal with things that would take longer than overnight to run through. In fact, the caching out of the data was sometimes as long or longer than the actual simulation part, and we could tune the simulation, you know, do it lower res just to see if it's flowing right, then crank it up to get the final thing. That was one of the great things about Flowline, is the efficiencies we could get out of it. The longest time was trying to come up with settings that worked.
Can I talk to you about those collision detection stuff, though? Because it seemed to me that that's where the computational problem was going to come, because there's a lot of stuff in that room. Now, I'm guessing, but would most of that stuff, bar close foreground, have been all digital?
There was a lot of digital extension. The set was pretty amazing. I think there was maybe 8 stack bases that really were built from furniture on one of the biggest stages. But anything that went up more than, say, 20, 30 feet, and anything that went back a few stacks was all digital, which, of course, meant that the collisions were easier to set off because we didn't have to match move stuff. But also because we decided that the river of fire could be kind of gaseous and not extremely specifically liquid, then our collisions didn't have to be 100% everywhere.
Right, because if it was liquid, I guess you'd expect it to carry debris and knock stuff forward, where I don't think I saw that. I think I saw more that idea of it engulfing in flames. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And there was a few shots I was going to try to carry some furniture along, but it was decided just be too distracting.
Yeah. And so presumably the actors were shot on that stage. There obviously was no need for flame, but did you do contact lighting and stuff? Or
so there was a programmable set of spotlights up on the ceiling grid. It was the same, I believe, the same system we used on Potter 5 for the fireworks dragon sequence, where they would work out based on the previs and as part of the actress locking, you know, these chasing spots that could be triggered and repeatable. And obviously they didn't always do exactly what we wanted, because we couldn't know when we shot some of the timings. It certainly gave us what we needed to make the stuff work.
So those faces, those characters at the front, were just all keyframe animated. The kind of, because there's a kind of hints of more sort of specific faces, but I think that also comes back again when the Horcrux is busted and kicked back into the Room of Requirements.
Yeah, when the Horcrux is destroyed, those are Voldemort's faces within the fire. Previous to that, it's a serpent, a dragon, and a lion, but very sort of rough models designed to make a readable, interesting fire sim, not for the audience to go, oh, that was a lion. And even the keyframing was done to give very just broad choreography and timing. We didn't go in and do facial animation or anything, obviously, because it's all represented in fire. The more graphic, the better.
Yeah. And actually, while we're on characters, Nagini, the snake, obviously played a role in part one as much as it was a role in part two. But in this last two films, it just felt like, I don't know, the snake was, dare I say it, better than we'd seen before. It was bad before, but it just certainly had less CG about it, though it was probably required to do more. I'm presuming that you gave the snake a reworking for these last two films, but I think that worked really well.
Yeah, we definitely went into Deathly Hallows 1 with the idea that given the enhanced role, especially by the time we get to part 2, Nagini really needed an overhaul. So we went out and cast a python, brought it in, and did lots of reference photography, and decided that whatever had been done before, this was now going to be Nagini, like pretty much from scratch. You know, we kept some of character development and the ways that she might react to things. But as far as an asset, it was a complete rebuild for the first film. And then her role in Deathly Hallows 2 was really the same asset, but many more shots.
And there was some other character work done by NPC, like the Stone Knights, was that right?
Yep, the moment when Professor McGonagall brings alive the statues that jump down and tromp out to defend the castle. That was one of our hero character pieces, and I'm trying to think of... It was an interesting development process because in the previs, they had a little bit more of like a ninja attack, kind of cool, quick moves. But as we got them into the plates and to scale and made of stone, we had to start slowing them down and giving them a bit more weight and solidity than the previs probably has in it.
Yeah, that first one drops with enormous weight, doesn't it? Really sort of hits the deck, and there's almost no secondary animation, so it just feels really solid.
Yeah, we were trying to figure out the stone statues. Are they really statues? And, you know, eventually David said that, you know, when they're not doing something, they're not doing something. They go back to statue, which I think worked out really well. At first, it seemed like too good to be true. Suddenly, we don't have to animate a bunch of these shots where they're standing there. We thought we'd have to do mocap idle clips for stone statues, which we couldn't figure out what that would be. But luckily, what they really do is they go and become statues somewhere else, in this case, all along the viaduct, to give as much resistance as possible for the impending attack, which I don't know at all whether the characters are meant to know there's giants coming, but you can sort of tell that the giants make pretty quick work of the Stone Knights initially.
Though I kind of got this flash reference to the Chinese soldier statues, you know, those burial kind of things that they unearthed in China, where you've got just rows and rows of these stone statues. And I think maybe consciously or subconsciously, that idea of these sort of just, they're in the way, but they're kind of solid, but without being kind of, I guess, fluid, works. I mean, obviously the giants are going to make a mess of things, but then everything... Then you sort of expect that, wouldn't you? Now let's get to
And they're also the.
Go on.
Sorry, the Stone Knights are disposable. I mean, they know what their role is, and they're happy to perform it, I guess.
Yeah, we don't expect to cry for a stone statue.
Yeah.
So let's get to Voldemort's final death. Obviously, about the most anticipated death in cinema history, certainly in recent times, and in the books that is obviously played out without. Any particular reference to this idea of how you came up with Voldemort disintegrating. So where did that come from and how early did it take time to develop?
I was worried you were going to ask where the idea came from because the other day I was trying to figure that out too. It was one of those lots of ideas flying around and somehow the one of him breaking up into pieces, somehow that one stuck. We explored a whole bunch of kind of strange ones, but they were all taking, they would have taken too much screen time to do. They weren't necessarily harder or easier than what we did. But somehow the breaking up of his figure and then it lifting up into the sky seemed to hit the right notes as far as it's not particularly evil the way he goes out. I mean, it's not pretty as he's breaking up, but one of the things we did by turning each of his sort of flaky bits into this ashen gray and then ending with some sun breaking through, it gives you a sense that maybe he was the most evil person in the world, but at the very end, it turns into a pretty picture. You don't leave with that, all the darkness. So we tried to do a fluid sim that was long, fluidy, and kind of goes gray.
So I presume you had a body scan of the actor?
Yeah, I mean, over the years, we've had a number of different scans to fall back on, you know, for all the nose work that's been done over the years, and we had his figure. As we built up to the effect, we started taking over pieces. You know, the first shot where the spell goes into his body, we just augmented 3D on top of the plate, and then the next shot, we removed his hands and replaced them with shriveled up versions digitally. We started patching in CG pieces to his face to give him a real sunken-in look. And then we started adding the flakes tearing off on top as well. So we kept as much of the actor for as long as we could, not just because that's a quicker route to realism, but because we knew how important it was to the director that the performance was there. You know, this isn't stuff they took lightly. The actor was knowing this is Voldemort dying as well, and if we got anywhere near, you know, tweaking his eyes or eyelids, I think we couldn't have done it any better, and we shouldn't have. So we tried to keep everything we could.
Tell me what the base plate photography of that was like. I presume it was on some kind of partial set, or was it on green screen? Or
The final shot of him actually disintegrating up into camera, that was all CG. Double Negative provided the courtyard set as part of their digital miniatures. And then everything we did was a digital Voldemort. There's a little bit of digital Harry there. All the shots previous to that big pullback were all shot on the courtyard set with a green screen off the end.
And did you have anything to help with tracking and stuff, or was it pretty much just some good, solid object tracking?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. I remember there's always a few little red dots out there. We can do a lot with just tracking rigid architecture that we know pretty well from scans. But the on-set crew were always throwing in a couple LEDs or tape marks so that we'd always have something in the frame that we could count on.
So could you give me a run-through just on that, if we just break down that breaking apart sequence, like what the pipeline was at your end, and also just sort of some idea on how long you had to work that shot through your pipeline?
Are you talking about the specific last shot or that little section of him dying post-Wanduul?
Yeah, that little section where obviously the spell goes into him and then it goes to the full CG particle disintegration.
Yep. So that little group of shots, we had a few test shots turned over probably before Christmas last year. We had a trailer shot or two that had been in the same area. So we had enough in the pipeline to know the space, but because of the recutting of the film, we really didn't get into his death specific shots or for real until maybe February. And we put together a sequence of events in a cheaper sort of straight comp way for the first temp screenings. And then with all that locked down, we started doing, you know, building an emaciated hand, building an emaciated head with two different modes, sort of first level emaciation, and then even further. We did a series of textures that were a kind of bruised up skin, as well as this frostbite blackened skin look, both for his hands and his face. For his face, we didn't end up using some of that stuff as aggressively. We pretty much made his hands go frostbitten and shriveled up. But when it came to his face, as we got into it, we realized that if we're going to be flaking skin off of it, we didn't really need to be also grading and making it all sorts of interesting colors or anything.
Now, just to be clear about this was shot on film, so I think it was like on Arri's with Cook S4. So you would have been handed over just 2K DPX film scans?
Yep. Yep, DPX 2K, yep.
Was it shot on like the 500 or 200? In other words, how grainy was it?
I don't remember grain being a particular issue. Right. I think it was 500 series, but I'm not sure.
Okay. So you had pretty clean, pretty nice stuff to work with.
Yeah, it was kind of what we've been used to, the state of the art of shooting film. Now that it's gotten digital, each film represents another, like, more or less grainy, different color channels, but you know, this was our maybe one of the last times we'll use what has been our classic pipeline for a number of years. You know, the grain level tight, but there, we know how to work with it.
Because you anticipate going to digital cinematography, or because you anticipate going to a different pipeline?
Oh no, just because most films we're working on now are being shot digitally,
yeah.
And you know, every camera is going to bring in its own little difference to the picture.
And of course, we should also point out that while this film was screened stereoscopically, you were given mono plates because it was dimensionalized later, right?
Yeah, the whole film was shot mono. We discussed very briefly getting some stereo camera rigs for the last of the shooting, because there was a brief hiatus before going into the battle shooting, but we ended up sticking with the same approach. Everything else was shot principal. And then a lot of dimensionalization, and of course any of the full 3D shots usually went through just stereo production.
But I interrupted you. You're discussing the face and how you didn't need to get as detailed with using that stuff, I guess, is your point.
Yeah, I think we it's not obviously not a subtle effect, but we tried to not push it where we didn't need to. So once his hands had been affected, we kind of left them alone as, okay, we've told that story. Now his face starts to degrade, and then the flakes start coming off, and we avoided doing anything like adding any atmospherics or too much playing of light, and just let the actor's performance plus the hero effect do the storytelling, get to the next shot, really to keep the story clear and simple. And a lot of this stuff really was the last shots we did. In fact, the very last shot of the film for us, and I believe we were the last vendor to complete as well, poetically, was the death of Voldemort. You know, the big last shot of his character was, I believe, the last visual effect shot done on the whole franchise.
Wow. Now, Bellatrix had died in screen time recently and had a distinctive imploding kind of death. Was there any thought to make that different or not match or match or anything like that? Or was it?
That's a good question. I didn't even know that she... I hadn't seen how she died when I was doing any of this, so okay. It's possible when Tim or David were looking at our stuff, they may be steering us around it. I'm not sure.
And so, presumably, what sort of actual apps were you using to, like, what was the pipeline? What in-house tools, for example, were you using to do this conversion to particles?
Oh, that's a good question. I know that, you know, Maya is still our basis for most 3D effects, although we've got tons of custom fields and custom routines that run within it.
Because you have your own destruction toolkit, don't you, which you would have used on a lot of...
There is the destruction toolkit Kali, K-A-L-I, we used for the Stone Knight destruction, but I think that was pretty much it. Certainly the stuff involving Voldemort was more traditional particle simulations, with instance geometry and even some custom cloth bits for up close to camera. But that kind of destruction, when it came to his face, if anything, we were leveraging off some techniques we had worked out in an X-Men film where Professor X's face flakes off.
Okay. And it was, there was no Houdini or anything? You was pretty much sticking with your own custom stuff in Maya?
Yep, so far we aren't using Houdini, certainly didn't use it on the Potter productions.
And this stuff, when rendered, is presumably OpenEXRs feeding into what, a Nuke pipeline?
Yep, RenderMan to EXR to Nuke.
Do you like to do a sort of a multi-pass approach on this stuff, or do you like to sort of nail it pretty much? Because I know you're doing skin, but and that would sometimes dictate subsurface scattering and trying to get it in one, but then again, the skin is not really skin, it's flaky bits, so...
Yeah, I know, and it's heavy makeup on an actor with prosthetics, and
yeah.
I mean, we did. We try to, you know, go as far as we can in 3D, so that compositing is picking up something that's more than in the ballpark. But when it came to this, this kind of effects work, the compositor, in this case, the lead for that whole section, he really was working with lighting to say, just give me all these broken down, you know, give me clean skin, bruised skin, flake skin, and I'll do the combination and balancing. And especially for those shots, I think it was the right choice. He really needed that fine control.
Greg, these films, especially the last ones, have got really distinctive grade. And this last film in particular, even more than part one for me, just had a spectacularly gorgeous grade. But obviously, traditionally, the grade is done obviously after the effects work. What were you working with in terms of the look of these? Because they are so distinctively graded and magnificently. But I mean, you know, your principal photography is obviously come in bright and chirpy and full sort of color. Where was it? Did you have LUTs provided for looks, or what was the look development on that?
On this last two films, the color pipeline was pretty well locked down. Peter Doyle and the DI team got ahead of everybody and dictated, here are the viewing LUT 3 or projectors, here's how to, you know, deliver all these files in quick times. And as he's done for years, he handed out balanced neutral grades for all plates to all facilities, and then a viewing lookup, which was mainly just darker. What happened after that, once we delivered everybody's stuff in, I'm sure they went further, but having not seen the film yet, all I can say is I'm looking forward to the look of the film as well.
Well, can I just say, great, it's a good film. I think you're going to enjoy it.
I'm sure I will. Everybody I know so far has, you know, said more than just it was pretty good. So,
but on a serious note, the reason I'm discussing that, because when you're trying to balance out those elements, if you start crushing the blacks, for example, that's going to make a big difference to what is readable or not. And so it is actually pretty important that your final nuke team has a in-the-ballpark feeling for the grade so that they can balance those things out, I'm presuming.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it would be really interesting to see that the difference between what we worked with as a primary grade and what DI then did, but I have a feeling that, I mean, a lot of it's trust now between all the facilities involved, the visual effects department and DI. We've done a couple, I mean, multiple films in a row, and everybody's used to a certain, like, expectation of if these plates go out and they're viewed this way, DI gets them back, and they're not going to break them, and they're testing as they go because all of the reviews go through DI, so there's really no surprises. And I think a lot of credit as well goes to the DOP for getting a lot of the look in the photography. So really, as you turn it down, it just looks better. Every time we had a problem on one of our nighttime shots, we just, Tim would have us go darker, and it suddenly just got better without breaking. And, you know, it would be one thing if we were doing a lot of work in the blacks and then they cranked it up, but I don't think that really happened. I think it went the other way, which means we always were kind of basically working in a safe environment, a controlled environment, and with so many vendors working together, having a DI set up like that and good photography, I think, shows.
I thought it was more than just crushing the blacks. It was just a magnificent textural color palette that gave the film, I'm not trying to wax lyrical, but it really just felt like that kind of impressionist master, like it was shot and printed on some kind of textured canvas or blotting paper. It was just spectacular looking stuff, your in sequences. Hey, let me ask you this, though, that you said it went through DI for the reviews. So just in terms of logistics, how did that work? Like, let's say you've got the shots and you know they're not finals yet, but, you know, you obviously want to run them through the director of the way that the camera work is happening on the lifting up from the particles of Voldemort's death. You're then handing files over to somewhere else that's screening them? I mean, how does that screening process work for you getting notes back and reviews?
Usually we'd have to finish our day kicking off transfers of a quick time for their editorial, which would then... So we'd send over the quick time. We'd send over the DPX files onto their server. The DI server was set up to automatically, if you followed the right, you know, guidelines, it would pull them in, drop them into a timeline. Some of you would get in really early before the review, check it out. Tim would check it out just ahead of David coming in. David would view it all in the DI suite. And then if it got approved, it was only tentatively approved until he made it over to editorial where they had the corresponding quick time. So it was like the DI process was for approval of the shot. And then editorial, within sort of 24 hours, would say, and there's no problems here. You know, we didn't miss a frame. It still works in continuity with whatever they're up to. So it actually flowed pretty well once everybody got all the procedures down.
And on that sequence where it's got live action and computer graphics, did you hand over another break for the dimensionalization of it? Or was it just, hey, as far as I'm concerned, it's mono, but if somebody wants to do something with stereo with it, knock yourself out?
It was a combination. I think we did about 70 shots stereo delivery, and then for everything else we did on the show, we would give a package of materials to whatever vendor happened to be doing that dimensionalization. It was always in the form of a mini comp, so we'd break out all the layers, not every layer, but the layers in such a way that it could be dimensionalized, and then we'd supply a nuke script that pointed to it all. so that whoever picked that up should be able to not recreate the whole comp, but recreate enough of the comp using a stereo approach. For our, we definitely had some dimensionalization shots as well. It wasn't all full CG. So we had a separate team working on those, not waiting till it was final to start, but waiting until it was final to, you know, go too far. They'd get everything ready to do all the prep and roto and everything.
Because that's, if we just back up to the rendering requirements from a 3D point of view for a second, if I'm staging a 3D shot, I may want to distribute in Z space the props and stuff slightly differently so that there's a sort of a foreground, midground, and background more. Whereas if I'm doing it just as a mono shot, you know, it can be a long lens and I don't care. I could, was there a consideration to spatial structuring and spatial staging, or was it more just in terms of the shot working?
We didn't really, I don't know if this is a bad thing or not, but when we were composing shots in general production in that sequence, we didn't give a lot of thought to the stereo. When we got to the flying kids, we thought a bit more, but those were shots that we were always going to deliver stereo ourselves. So none of those shots really got finaled until we had locked down the depth anyway. But when it comes to the big room itself, another company did the dimensionalization of really everything before the fire occurs, which has got to be some of the toughest dimensionalization around. I mean, there's stuff in the foreground out of focus, complicated. There's
it's
edges everywhere and everything. Everything parallaxes too.
Yeah.
So I don't envy their task. Apparently they did it pretty well. So
oh,
I'm
they
impressed.
Did it. It was good. It was very good. The flying stuff, though, again, was still shot mono. So you only had the actors, or were they predominantly CD doubles? I think they looked like they were actors for...
Yeah, there's only about one shot. I think maybe one or two shots where there was digital doubles involved. Yeah, two shots. Whenever they were a plate, for most of those, we had to roto-animate a character to project onto. So when Harry flies up in front of camera, his elbow sticks out more than his chest. So it's all 2D photography dimensionalized.
But for Draco being whipped up onto the back of the broom and stuff, I'm guessing that was digital doubles?
That was 2D. Yeah, that was filmed stuff dimensionalized.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've reached the end of this incredible body of work, and obviously for yourself, several of the films. I'm wondering, on a film of this scale moving forward, if you had another major project, is there any sort of big lessons from this? You said that you'd probably think that it's more likely to be a digital workflow just dictated by digital cinematography. But, I mean, this seems to be a very refined pipeline. Are there lessons moving forward?
Definitely. I mean, especially when it comes to multiple vendors working on something, because these days it's hard to do one big show in a single facility. And it's best to get everything planned out. You know, DI is rarely just a back-end thing now, but even more, it's important to get all that stuff settled up front to treat, especially with dimensionalization, stereo, and shared vendors, to start treating some of these digital sets like a real set. You know, lock your world spaces, your scales, agree everything up front so that when you have to start exchanging material, things work and you don't get stuck badly. Also, just the Potter clients, they've just been great. They know what they want. They know what they're doing. They're up front. And I hope to work with, you know, any of them again on different projects as we all go off into different things now. I guess trust, you know, find a way early on to build up a trust between not only the different vendors, but obviously the clients, because when things get hard, you want to fall back on that so that things don't have to be ugly. They can just be hard together and you'll come out friends in the end.
Look, speaking as an outsider and just as an observer, I'd have to say that the English visual effects community, which, let's face it, didn't start as the principal Harry Potter effects team. I mean, you guys basically earned the right to do this. And then as an industry, the London houses basically, you know, delivered on these end ones. And so it sort of basically, not that the London houses weren't producing good work before Potter, but now, I think you've shown the world a level of cooperation and basically non-bitchiness between the facilities that is almost unprecedented anywhere else in the world. I don't think anywhere else in the world has such a tight working, obviously still competitive, environment between the London houses. I mean, they're just, it's amazing. I hope that that'll continue. I guess for the industry that you've now faced with an issue to obviously generate the kind of work that'll keep all that number of artists busy. But if anything's in your favour, it has to be the way that the facilities collaborate. You must have just, I mean, there just is a phenomenal amount of support between the facilities, though you obviously compete against each other.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I was in London for over 6 years, and when I started, it wasn't quite that same, not quite cozy, but I mean, it wasn't as agreeable. It was a bit more tense between all the facilities fighting over work and artists. And although there's a similar level of competitiveness now because there's lots of work and lots of artists to bring work in for, somehow things have grown up now and everybody kind of knows the boundaries and knows that any day now we could all be on a film together. So get it all out of the way. Once the work's awarded, just start sharing whatever you can to make it successful for everybody. And I think the Potters, you know, that 10 years of work meant that facilities could try things on Potter, get good at it, and then use that to get in work that normally without the Potter pedigree wouldn't be coming. There's a chance for us all to like learn how to do it and do it really well.
And I guess the other thing, this isn't the only large scale mega Academy Award winning sort of series of films you've done, obviously Lord of the Rings. So you must also have a really good sense of creating assets for that, you know, with a perspective beyond the end of the 9 month production cycle you're on, because obviously down at Weta, you did, you know, they did that and you've done it in England. Do you take that forward with your own work to sort of keep those ideas of building more longer term tools and assets?
Yeah, it's funny how I just take it for granted that that's something to be done, and I forget that a lot of people are used to working on films that are just one-off. Obviously, I mean, these days things are changing. There's so many sequels that it would kind of be dumb not to be working on a project and make sure that you're open to part two coming. If not for you, then the studio saying, send all your stuff to this other place. That's what Lord of the Rings is all about. You know, build everything at the beginning for three films. And obviously you can't really do that fully, but if you start that way, it's like with Nagini, by the eighth film, we had had a chance to not chuck it out and start over, but continue to revamp until, you know, we'd done it so many times, I would be really disappointed if she didn't look really good, because we should get it right by now.
Plus, the more efficient you are, and efficiency is kind of a dirty word, but the more efficient you are, the more you can spend time on the creative stuff and not be wasting time on kind of the grunt work that's already been done. Not redoing stuff is a great asset.
I think that's why efficiency shouldn't be a dirty word. Efficiency is what gets you, you know, hopefully making some money so you can keep the place open, but more importantly, it lets you and all the artists focus on the things that aren't button pushing or the things that shouldn't be efficient. You should have time to think, how can I make this better? And if you spend half a day finding a way to make your shot better because you saved half a day of what used to be button pushing, that's great.
Well, on behalf of my two daughters, who literally, when I was in London, dragged me down to Trafalgar Square with the other 10,000, 20,000 Potter fans for the premiere, and who have already seen the film twice. So on their behalf, I can say a heartfelt thank you. It's brilliant work, and we really enjoyed the film, so thanks so much.
Thanks. It's really been an honor to be part of that franchise.
Well, thanks, Greg and Mike, for that great interview. The movie itself, I thought, was fantastic, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, and my wife and I actually came home and watched the first Harry Potter, and it's really amazing to see how well those films have held up and how consistent that series was. So I think everybody's been very happy with the final chapter and kind of the way the series ended up and the way that last movie kind of brings everything together, and really great work by everybody involved. Well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. For my partners Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, we'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.